Trump's back.
Probably Donald Trump should have just issued a crypto token, called it DJT, gone around saying, "This is the crypto token of me, Donald Trump," kept 90% of it for himself, and let it trade. People who liked Trump would buy it, it would go up, his stake would be worth billions of dollars, and he could sell tokens to raise money for himself. Just a straightforward meme coin. I suppose the problem with this is that Trump has a lot of older, less crypto-native fans, and this would not be an effective way to tap them for money.
But you can get arbitrarily close to this, while attracting a more traditional investor base, by issuing a stock called DJT, and Trump did. DJT, the ticker symbol of Trump Media and Technology Group Corporation, is a meme stock with a market capitalization, as of yesterday's close, of about $7 billion. It is the stock token of him, Donald Trump, and he owns about 58% of it. People who like Trump bought it, it went up, his stake is worth billions of dollars, and he will eventually be able to sell shares to raise money for himself, though there is a 6-month lockup.
It is a small technical problem that you probably cannot just do this. You cannot just issue stock that is like, this is the stock with my name on it, go buy it. You can't start a company and take it public to be purely a meme stock. I cannot give you a really crisp explanation of why not. I'm not aware of any provision of U.S. securities law that is like, if you raise money for a public company, it has to do something, or at least try. It's just, you know, if you say, I am launching a company with my name on it, and that's it, then underwriters probably will not want to work with you. And lawyers will be confused writing the prospectus, and eventually the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission will have to sign off on the prospectus and will find reasons not to.
But, again, you can get arbitrarily close. You can take a teeny tiny operating business, wrap it in a meme stock, and sell that. The most famous example, it's not exactly a meme stock, but close enough, was the New Jersey deli that had $13,976 of revenue and a $2 billion market capitalization. Or, I mean, there was a deli, it had $13,976 of revenue, it was the only operating business of a public company, and that public company had a $2 billion market capitalization. But it wasn't like people were paying $2 billion for that deli. The stock traded at $2 billion, for other reasons, and also there happened to be a deli. The deli was almost irrelevant to the stock, but not quite. If there wasn't a deli, if the public company couldn't put out filings with some description of some business and some financial statements, then there couldn't be a stock. The stock's price had nothing to do with the deli, but the stock's existence required the deli.
Similarly, DJT, the stock, is a $7 billion token, while Trump Media and Technology Group, the company, is fairly small. Last year it lost $58 million on $4 million of revenue.
About as lucrative as a top Substack newsletter, I called it, but vastly more expensive to run. But if you take a small business with Trump's name and ownership and wrap it in a stock, you can make a big meme stock.
We discussed this the other day, but it creates a lot of strange corporate issues. Consider the deli. What sort of salary would you expect to earn for running the deli? One way to answer that question is to consider how much proprietors of other delis with $14,000 of annual revenues earn. Not much. Another way to answer the question is to consider how much chief executive officers of other $2 billion public companies earn. More. Similarly, with DJT TMTG, should its executives get paid like the executives of a company with $4 million of revenue or one with $7 billion of market cap?
Or here is a story from Bloomberg's Jeff Feely about a fight over the division of the spoils.
Donald Trump has sued two co-founders of his newly public Trump Media and Technology Group Corp., claiming they set the company up improperly and shouldn't get any stock in it.
In the latest legal skirmish over who gets how much of the hot but flailing meme stock, Trump alleges that Andy Latinsky and Wes Moss violated an agreement about the setup and don't deserve their 8.6% stake, currently valued at $606 million.
The lawsuit, which was filed on March 24th in Florida State Court and hasn't previously been reported, comes after the pair brought their own suit against the former president in Delaware Chancery Court over their promised stake in the social media company.
Here is the complaint, which basically alleges that Latinsky and Moss, former contestants on President Trump's famous television show, The Apprentice, did an incompetent job of launching TMTG's media business and finding a merger partner. And, fine, I can believe that. They did manage to find an illegal merger partner.
But I think that the broader point here is that Latinsky and Moss were hired to set up TMTG's rather small and speculative business, and it is absurd to reward them with 8.6% of DJT's much larger meme stock. My favorite part of the complaint is not actually in the complaint, but in the exhibit at the end, in which Trump's lawyers reproduce the services agreement between him and Litinsky and Moss. It just has a very small business feel, you know? Their role included ensuring that TMG becomes an established entity registered under the laws of the state of Delaware, and creating and implementing a strategic plan to identify, exploit, and commercialize targeted media and technology opportunities in social media, internet infrastructure, podcast, digital streaming, mobile apps, book publication, and television production. There was not much vision. Their job was to set up the company and look around for something for it to do.
A schedule to the agreement lists guidelines for reimbursable expenses. Litinsky and Moss were entitled to reimbursement for economy, coach or supersaver fares on flights and trains, though 21-day advance purchase is expected, when possible. Reasonable hotel bills were reimbursable, where under $150 per night is typically reasonable for most cities. Laundry and dry cleaning were not normally reimbursed for planned trips of less than 1 week. They had to submit receipts for any individual expenditure of $10 or more. This is not Facebook Incorporated's charter, is what I am saying here. This is set up a small business for me, but don't spend more than $150 a night on hotels. And now they might get $600 million.
Hunter Brook.
I wrote yesterday that Hunter Brook, the hedge fund that is also a newspaper, is a sort of salary arbitrage. Hunter Brook Media is a news organization that employs reporters to write investigative stories, and then it gives those stories to Hunter Brook Capital, its affiliated hedge fund, to make trades before the stories are published. If the stories are right and market moving, then the hedge fund will make money, which it can use to pay for the news organization. I wrote, it is expensive to hire hedge fund analysts to investigate companies all over the world. It is cheaper to hire journalists.
But Hunter Brook also has another, much funnier expense arbitrage. It goes like this.
If you are a hedge fund conducting due diligence on a company, you will probably want to speak to experts. You might pay an expert network firm to put you in touch with industry experts. You might engage consultants to evaluate the business. If you think the company might have legal issues, you will talk to specialist lawyers to help evaluate those issues. In each case, you will call up the experts and say, "Hi, I work at Hedge Fund X, we are evaluating company Y, and we'd like to get your views." And those experts will probably say something like, "Sure, that will be $2,000 per hour with a $10,000 minimum." And you'll say, "Yes, perfect, send an invoice to our billing department. You have a budget for this stuff." If you are a newspaper reporter investigating a company, you will probably want to speak to experts, industry experts, lawyers, etc. You will call up the experts and say, "Hi, I am a reporter for the Z Daily News, I am writing a story about company Y, and I'd like to get your views." And those experts might say something like, "Sure, I would love to get my name in the paper, here is a pithy quote." Or they might say, "I don't want to be quoted, but on background," and then tell you stuff. Or occasionally, but not that often, they might say, "Sure, I'll talk to you, but I'll need $2,000 per hour with a $10,000 minimum." In that case, you will say, "Oh no, you don't understand, I am a journalist, it is unethical for me to pay sources." And then they'll probably hang up, which is fine, you'll call someone else who wants to be quoted.
You see the arbitrage. Hunter Brook's consulting budget is probably smaller than that of other hedge funds.
Yesterday, Hunter Brook Media published its first big investigation of United Wholesale Mortgage, alleging that UWM's conduct could constitute fraud and run afoul of laws passed after 2008 to protect borrowers. Hunter Brook Capital shorted UWM stock. If you want to figure out if a company's conduct runs afoul of laws, one thing you might do is call up a lawyer and say, "Hey, is this conduct legal?" If you are a hedge fund and you do that, the lawyer will send you a bill. If you are a media organization, maybe she won't.
And so in fact, I heard yesterday from a lawyer who got that call, actually email, from Hunter Brook, and who replied to the effect of, "Sure, here are my rates." And they replied to the effect of, "No, our ethics policy does not allow us to pay sources." From Hunter Brook's website,
"At Hunter Brook Media, we abide by the five traditional standards re: source relationships, adapted from the New York Times.
1. Financial interactions. Don't pay sources, and don't let them pay you or pay for you."
The lawyer replied to the effect of, "Man, you are not fooling me. When investment firms call me for analysis, I charge them. They did not hire him." Also, he forwarded me their exchange, commenting, "Normally, conversations in search of legal counsel are subject to confidentiality obligations under legal ethics, but I don't see how they can claim they were seeking legal advice or that the inquiry was confidential. They viewed me as a source. It's true. They weren't looking to hire him as a lawyer, but to interview him as a source, so he has no confidentiality obligations to them. If they had paid him, he would.
In other Hunterbrook news, it disclosed yesterday that its nonprofit affiliate has entered an agreement with Boies Schiller Flexner LLP in exploration of a class action lawsuit against UWM seeking restitution for homebuyers. The class action complaint was filed yesterday.
Over the past 3 years, UWM has issued nearly $39 billion in mortgages through independent brokers who refer 99% of their business to UWM. And during last year alone, more than 8,000 so-called independent brokers funneled 99% or more of their mortgages to UWM, worth at least $11.7 billion. In short, those brokers are not shopping around to other lenders. They are not seeking the best prices for their principals. They are instead captive to UWM. Through a series of intentional and illegal practices, UWM has thus corrupted a large swath of independent brokers and turned them into the functional equivalent of the loan officers that retail financial institutions use. These corrupted brokers are in essence employees in the UWM enterprise. And while doing that, both UWM and the corrupted brokers have concealed this fact from consumers who have been led to believe their independent brokers are working for them and shopping around to multiple lenders.
The consequences to UWM's borrowers have been devastating. UWM rarely offered the best available pricing throughout the past 4 years and routinely charged fees that substantially exceeded their competitors' offerings to the tune of billions of dollars. While UWM's borrowers believed that their independent brokers were working for them, in reality, UWM induced thousands of these brokers to participate in their funneling scheme and enterprise by successfully infiltrating and corrupting their duties to the plaintiffs and the class.
Presumably Boies Schiller plans to get paid.
Blue Owl.
My stupid story of private credit is.
Once upon a time, there were insurance companies which had long-dated liabilities, annuities, life insurance, and funded them by buying and holding corporate bonds. This was a boring business. You bought the bonds, you literally clipped literal paper coupons to collect interest, and eventually the bonds matured and you got your money back in time to pay your liabilities. Then Bill Gross, a guy clipping coupons in the bond department at an insurance company, invented bond trading. It turned out that you could make more money by buying undervalued bonds and selling overvalued ones than you could by just buying and holding to maturity. This became a big business that was entirely separate from insurance. People, prominently including Gross, set up big bond investment companies that actively managed bond portfolios on behalf of clients, insurers and endowments, and mutual funds and others. Over time, the bond market became more efficient. All this liquidity and competition probably lowered borrowing costs for companies. At some point, people realized that now you can actually make more money by making loans and hold them to maturity. You collect an illiquidity premium for buying debt that doesn't trade. You structure loans to meet borrowers' needs so you can charge them a bit more than the bond market. And maybe you face a bit less competition. And so, private credit grew up as an alternative to the bond market. A problem with this business is that if you have outside investors, they might ask for their money back at any time. And if you mostly own illiquid private loans that you can't sell, that's a problem. What you want is a bunch of actuarially predictable long-dated liabilities, like an insurance company. So you buy an insurance company. The result is insurance companies with long-dated liabilities that are funded by buying and holding private debt. Somehow, this is not as boring a job as it was in step one, and it pays better.
This story is wrong in many details, and dumb, but it does seem sort of directionally accurate. The only business models are bundling and unbundling, and on a long enough time scale, all business stories are about both. Anyway,
one of Wall Street's fastest-growing firms is pushing into one of the hottest corners of finance.
The lender Blue Owl Capital said Wednesday it is buying Kuvare Asset Management, an asset manager tied to the insurance industry. The deal gives Blue Owl exposure to the sought-after insurance market, which the private markets investment firms have flocked to in recent years in their quest for more assets to manage.
Kuvare manages the assets of Kuvare UK Holdings, a life and annuity insurance company, and those of other insurers. Blue Owl is paying $750 million for Kuvare Asset Management and buying about $250 million of preferred equity in Kuvare UK Holdings, confirming a report from the Wall Street Journal earlier Wednesday.
Apollo Global Management sparked Wall Street's push into insurance when it helped create the insurer Athene in the aftermath of the 2008-09 financial crisis and built a massive credit business to manage its assets. Other private equity firms such as KKR, Blackstone and Brookfield have since bought insurers or struck deals to manage their assets.
In the olden days, buying debt at an insurance company and holding it to maturity was sleepy and boring. Now one of Wall Street's fastest-growing firms wants to do it because it is one of the hottest corners of finance.
Endeavor.
In some ways, if you want to acquire a public company in a merger or acquisition, it helps to already own most of the stock. In other ways, that makes it harder. Here's Endeavor.
Private equity giant Silver Lake agreed to take private Endeavor Group holdings in a deal that values the owner of talent agencies WME and IMG at $13 billion.
As part of the deal, Silver Lake agreed to pay $27.50 in cash for each Endeavor share it doesn't already own. The private equity firm already had a stake of more than 30% in Endeavor, according to FactSet.
Endeavor shares were up 2.3% to $25.87 in afternoon trading.
The deal builds on a string of investments Silver Lake has made in Endeavor, from its initial 2012 investment in WME to Endeavor's 2021 initial public offering.
Silver Lake owns about 30% of Endeavor, but it has super voting stock, giving it about 70% of the total voting power. Endeavor's Chief Executive Officer Ari Emanuel and Chairman Patrick Whitesell also own super voting stock and are part of the buyout group. They will keep their stock in the newly private Endeavor.
This creates a conflict of interest. Silver Lake and the executives would like to buy the rest of Endeavor as cheap as possible, and they already control it. The other shareholders would like to get paid as much as possible, but Emanuel runs the company and Silver Lake controls the vote. If it proposed a merger at 1 cents per share, that would get majority approval from shareholders.
Of course, everyone knows this, and there are rules and safeguards to protect the minority holders. The main one is that Endeavor's board of directors set up a special committee of independent directors, who negotiated the deal on behalf of the independent shareholders. They got $27.50, not 1 cent.
Still, these deals are always controversial, and often lead to lawsuits claiming that the special committee did not really protect independent shareholders and that the insiders got a sweetheart deal. We have discussed this in the Tesla SolarCity and Sculptor deals. I feel like the Endeavor lawsuit will be fun. Here is Endeavor's 8K announcing the deal, which notes that it has already gotten shareholder approval. Silver Lake, Emanuel and Whitesell have already voted their shares to approve the merger, and they control a majority of the vote.
But it also lists the various sweeteners that Emanuel, Whitesell and other executives are getting in the deal, including new equity deals and royalty payments. Also, they each get a plane.
Following the effective date of the mergers, ownership and operation of one of the private planes owned by the company and its subsidiaries, other than TKO Group Holdings Inc. and its subsidiaries, collectively, the employer group, will transfer to Mr. Emanuel. The employer group will pay or reimburse him for reasonable costs and expenses related to the use of the plane for business purposes of the employer group.
Following the effective time, ownership and operation of one of the employer group's private planes will transfer to Mr. Whitesell. The employer group will pay or reimburse him for reasonable costs and expenses related to the use of the plane for the company and WME business purposes.
The lawsuit kind of writes itself. The minority shareholders will complain that the Silver Lake deal undervalues the company, that the board of directors could have gotten more value for shareholders, but instead let Silver Lake and the executives get a sweet deal for themselves. The minority shareholders didn't each get a plane, but the executives did.
Things happen.
Fed blocks tough global climate risk rules for Wall Street banks. Venture capital reckons with the end of mega fund era. Business schools are going all in on AI. Musk's XAI is poaching engineers from Tesla. Canada's RBC struggles to go green while financing oil. Beyond memes, Robinhood seeks to broaden its appeal. Donald Trump's lenders of last resort, subprime Auto King and online bank. Dividends outstrip cash flows at Blackstone's flagship property fund. Billionaire Steve Cohen said he expects that more businesses will move to a four-day work week, one of the reasons he's made investments in golf. Bluey, Styx.
If you'd like to get money stuff in handy email form, right in your inbox, please subscribe at this link. Or you can subscribe to Money Stuff and other great Bloomberg newsletters here. Thanks.
And Josh Marshall points to a filing in which Trump Media says that it does not currently and may never collect, monitor, or report certain key operating metrics used by companies in similar industries, including signups, average revenue per user, ad impressions and pricing, or active user accounts, including monthly and daily active users.
In fact, its CEO, Devin Nunes, got $750,000 last year.